Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Today on the Brian Lehrer Show, it's a family meeting on race and justice. Is this a tipping point? Does the intense focus after Ferguson and Staten Island make this a moment when meaningful change might actually be at hand for the way police operate in low-income minority communities? And could it be a moment when we come to understand each other on race better than this?
How about you reduce crime?
This is a debate. When I become mayor, I'll do that.
The white police officers won't be there if you weren't killing each other.
Hang on. It's the defensive mechanism of white supremacy.
Rudy Giuliani and Michael Eric Dyson on Meet the Press last month. The September 10th Rudy is back, but heavy-handed or not, he speaks for much of white America. Pew poll results released this week show 64% of white Americans think the Ferguson grand jury got its decision right. 80% of blacks think they got it wrong on the Eric Garner, Daniel Pantaleo case here in New York. 90% of blacks said the grand jury got it wrong, and just 47% of whites thought it was the wrong decision. We'll come back to the vast gulf in racial perception and see if we can bridge it a little bit later in the program. But let's begin with some newly revealed differences about race and the police here in New York, just unearthed by our data news team. Noah Veltman from the data news team is here, along with WNYC criminal justice correspondent Robert Lewis. Hi, Noah. Hi, Robert.
Hello.
Hey, Brian.
So you studied court records here in the city since 2012. Noah, what did you find out about resisting arrest statistics?
So looking at a variety of criminal court cases for some of the most common offenses in New York City, things like low-level drug possession, petty theft, possession of stolen property, disorderly conduct, driving without a license, we found a consistent racial disparity between your likelihood of getting an additional resisting arrest charge, depending on whether you're white or black. In the case of drug possession, for example, black defendants are almost twice as likely as white defendants to get an additional resisting arrest charge for the same original crime.
Robert, what would you add to that?
Well, I would just say, it's fascinating data. Resisting arrest has been a big question mark, or a big area that I think everyone's looking at after the Eric Garner case. I mean, the whole justification for the force in a lot of ways that was used was, oh, well, he was resisting arrest. So it is an interesting indicator. It's something to look at that shows both relationship with a community and also maybe shows how police proceed.
And this is something that may seem obvious, but I think we should point out as part of the basis of this conversation is that when someone is charged with resisting arrest, it often means it wasn't going well, and so the officer is more likely to have used force, right?
Absolutely. I mean, I talked to a criminologist yesterday, and basically boiled down, he said if you see a resisting arrest charge, that indicates there was some sort of significant conflict. And you know, you have to look on a case-by-case basis. There are certainly cases where people are fighting the cops, and the flip side is there is allegations or a belief that sometimes resisting arrest is a sign that a cop went in hard, used force, and charged resisting arrest almost to excuse their use of force. Either way, there is a significant conflict happening there, and it's happening more often with blacks than it is with whites.
So let me open up the phones on this. And listeners, anybody out there right now who's ever been charged with resisting arrest? If so, do you feel badly about it now, or do you feel in some way that the police officer was provoking you into it? Any police officers listening right now? When do you charge somebody with resisting arrest, and how do you restrain yourself to help avoid a situation where you have to take somebody into custody for resisting arrest, which I'm sure you don't want to do? 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And if the rates are different in different communities by race or however you want to measure it, why does anyone listening, especially if you've been personally involved on either side of it, think that is? 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692, as we explore the meaning of these new numbers as collected by WNYC's data news team. So Noah Veltman from that news team, can you walk us through some of the numbers more specifically for a low-level drug arrest, for example? How likely is it that you'll also be charged with resisting arrest?
Sure. So since 2012, there are about 170,000 or so cases with a misdemeanor or below drug possession charge and no felonies involved. So for those cases, you have about a 2.5% chance overall of getting a resisting arrest charge. So the overall percentage is not that high. Most people are not getting these charges. But if you're a white defendant in one of those cases, you have a below average chance. You have a 1.7% chance. If you're a black defendant, you have about a 3.1% chance. So almost twice as likely. And that also varies by borough. So you have in the Bronx and Staten Island, you're almost twice, 2.5 times as likely as a white defendant to get the resisting arrest charge.
And also, by extension, if you're a black defendant on Staten Island, you're more likely to wind up with a resisting arrest charge than a black defendant in Manhattan picked up for the same thing?
Yes, yes.
So, Robert, why might that be? Are there any good theories?
There are some theories out there. Again, I ran it by a couple people. One theory I'd heard was that if there is a sense that a system is not legitimate, and by that I mean if within a community you feel that the justice system is not for you, is not fair to you, it's possible that you're going to react. There's a greater likelihood of reacting with noncompliance because you don't believe that it's legitimate why you're being stopped, and therefore you might even react with outright hostility. The flip side, though, I talked to the head of legal aid, Seymour James, and he sort of poo-pooed that a little bit and said, well, I don't think it's actually the aggression on the part of people in the community. He sort of said, I think it's the aggression on the part of the cops. They go in hard, and it sort of – they almost create a situation where someone is almost by default resisting. Those were the two theories I heard. And again, running by a criminologist, he said, you know, it's probably a little bit of both. And either way, if those are the two main reasons perhaps, it suggests a fundamental break in the relationship between communities of color and the NYPD.
So if there is the perception that the system is unfair, that their arrest in the first place is unjust, I guess it would tend to stem in 2014 from too many contacts over too many little things. So you look, Noah, at low-level drug arrests, as we just talked about, also at petty theft and disorderly conduct, one of the most minor things that people could possibly be charged with, right?
Yes.
So disorderly conduct, does that wind up in resisting arrest much of the time?
So there's more overlap with disorderly conduct and resisting than there is with something like a drug arrest.
Huh.
Disorderly conduct is a complicated situation, a sort of an add-on charge that tends to show up alongside other things. Your overall chance of getting resisting and disorderly conduct your overall charge of getting a resisting charge if you've been charged with disorderly conduct is higher than for drugs. It's about 9%.
Huh. Maybe you're already being disorderly, whatever that means.
Sure. And disorderly conduct and resisting arrest are both very, very vague statutes.
Right.
They're both fairly subjective.
They both
things.
Tend to be add-ons.
Yeah, I would just add to that, you know, talking to attorneys, they sort of talk about the classic three or the triumvirate, whatever you want to call it, and it's sort of the resisting arrest, the disorderly conduct, and the obstructing governmental administration. I mean, very often if you see one, it's very likely you'll see all three.
So on this notion that if you think you're not being treated fairly, you're more likely to resist as a matter of protest almost. I want to replay part of your report, Robert, from yesterday on an incident in Queens that resulted in a couple, a man and a woman, both arrested for resisting arrest in front of their children in their own driveway over what began as a ticket for riding his bicycle on the sidewalk. Now, listeners, if you were with us yesterday, you heard this. Many of you weren't with us at that particular moment. And even if you were, many of you are going to be interested to hear this a second time. So here again is that 2.5 minute stretch from our criminal justice correspondent Robert Lewis's piece that originally aired yesterday that included part of a tape recording that the woman made as the incident was unfolding. And this begins with her on the tape talking to the officer.
So you're saying that all of this I just saw was because he was riding on a sidewalk?
No, no. All this you just saw is because he started fighting us. When we asked for ID, that's why.
Okay.
I stopped in the house, you grabbed
me. Wait. Come here.
You punched me in my face with me. I'm resisting. Yeah, somebody trying to pull you out your house. What the you do?
Here's Officer Frascatori.
Ask me for your ID.
I said it's inside.
Listen,
I said I got to go and get it.
That's it. It's over with.
Hines asks the officers for their identification. Officer Costello politely complies. Here's her interaction with Frascatori.
I'm going to need everybody's, since you said last name and badge number, please.
Sorry?
I'm going to need everybody's last name and badge
number, please. We'll get to you when we're done doing our job. Thank you very much.
We're down the street.
And then things get out of hand. As cops took Diggs to their vehicle, Hines had one of her kids take the bicycle inside. But Frascatori wanted it for evidence. In the criminal complaint, Frascatori swore that Hines cursed at him and said she was taking the bike inside. He later tells an investigator about a tug of war over the bike with Hines outside the house.
Yeah, I grabbed the bike.
Okay. Tell me about that. What happened?
I grabbed the bike and she continued to pull into the house.
But none of that is backed up by the audio recording.
How you doing?
I'm fine.
Where's the bicycle that was out here?
It's my bike.
I need that bicycle. Thank you.
It's my bike.
It's evidence.
It's his bike.
It's evidence or I'm coming in the house.
Listen.
All three cops are involved in getting the bike back. It's unclear who says what. They all testify that they don't recognize any of the voices, including their own.
Bring the bike outside.
Could you back up a little bit, please?
No.
I feel
threatened.
You're about to come
That's
in.
Fine. That's fine.
I'm about to come in your house.
I'm sorry, don't.
And take the bike.
You're going to bring the bike out.
If this is what you want your kids to witness, that's fine. I'm going to arrest you and take the bike if you do not get out of my way and hand me the bike.
Go get the bike, ma'am.
If you can back up, please.
Go get the bike, ma'am.
I will get the bike.
You're going to get the bike.
But it's too late.
Are you touching me?
Are you going to go to jail now?
Are you touching me, too?
You're going to go to jail in 2 seconds.
I can't get the bike if you're holding me.
Get the bike right now.
Let go of me. Don't come in my house. Don't come in my house. Let go of me. Let me get the bike.
Frascatori arrests Hines, charges her with a felony for tampering with evidence, also obstructing governmental administration and resisting arrest. Her children, heard in the background, are 8 and 11.
He has the bike now. What's the problem?
You're going to jail.
I'm going to jail for what?
Because you don't listen. That's why. Thank you.
Oof. Incredible stuff from WNYC criminal justice reporter Robert Lewis. Robert, we played that today in light of your new reporting that you're here with this morning. So I can ask you this question. Is there anything in there anecdotally that seems to reflect any of the patterns of why when black New Yorkers have contact with the police, they're so much more likely than whites to wind up being charged with resisting arrest in addition to the underlying crime, which in this case was riding your bicycle on the sidewalk only?
Well, I would say that in the perceptions that I've heard in many of these communities and talking to attorneys who represent a lot of these a lot of folks who wind up in these situations is that things spiral out of control so quickly. Many people acknowledge that I've talked to effectively acknowledge that per the letter of the law, they are resisting. They don't follow the officer's instructions right away. Maybe they don't automatically give up their arms when they're asked to be handcuffed. But they spiral very, very quickly. And before you know it, it seems that a lot of force can conceivably be used.
And in that case, you heard the guy say, well, of course I was resisting following me in my house.
Right. And it should be pointed out, one of the allegations he made to the CCRB, the Civilian Complaint Review Board, was that there was an excessive use of force. And the Civilian Complaint Review Board looked at it and basically said he acknowledged that he tucked his arms in and wasn't letting them handcuff him. He was resisting. Cops are allowed to use force. Therefore, they couldn't substantiate that right. allegation.
And we should mention that the charges against both of the man and the woman in that couple were dropped, and one of the officers was found to have violated departmental procedures, right?
Yes. As I understand, disciplinary action is potentially still pending. His attorney wouldn't comment at this time. But yes, his allegation that he didn't give – he abused his authority was substantiated, and the false statements issue was referred to internal affairs.
All right. Well, let's hear some stories from some of our callers as we continue with WNYC criminal justice correspondent Robert Lewis and Noah Veltman from our data news team, looking at new numbers that data news has crunched, and Robert has helped them interpret on how much more likely it is to be accused of resisting arrest if you have contact with the police, if you're African-American, than if you're white, following some low-level crime like drug possession or disorderly conduct or petty theft allegation. Diane in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hello, Diane.
Hi. Well, the first thing I want to address is this discussion of use of force and the definition of it.
Well, before we get to that, you have a story. You were charged with resisting arrest?
Well, I was charged with, I've been charged with disorderly conduct, and I've been charged with resisting arrest. But can I just make one distinction?
Sure, of course.
You know, we've been talking about black men who are killed in this country. Well, there's use of force, which is, you know, roughing someone up to handcuff them, and there's use of force to kill somebody. And I keep hearing this talk of what somebody did and, you know, whether somebody looks scary and whether somebody robbed a convenience store. And, well, in this country, is that a reason to kill somebody? So, you know, I mean, does that excuse that? And that leads
All right, so
into...
Let's... Does it lead
yeah,
into because today we're talking about resisting arrest, or at least for these few minutes. So tell us your story or your comment on that.
Well, my point is that I was charged with resisting arrest at a protest, and there's a huge difference even once you get into the criminal justice system of how my, you know, black protesters who were protesting with me were treated. And the fact that it's terrifying to be around, even for a white privileged woman, it's very scary to be in a situation where you're not armed and someone who is very angry at you. And, you know, I mean, I think we speak too flippantly about each of these terms we use, resisting arrest, you know, how people respond. And, you know, so aside from the first thing I said, the other thing in terms of my own experience is that I think we have to include the fact that emotions run high and, you know, in terms of training, people have talked about that. And also how armed people are, like why don't police have tasers? Anyway, that's my comment. It's
Diane,
on the spectrum of treatment.
Thank you very, very much. Khalif in Harlem, you're on WNYC. Hello, Khalif.
Hey, good morning, Brian. Thank you for taking my call, sir.
Thank you for making it.
I listen to your show all the time. I'm actually, personally speaking, I'm in processing for the NYPD. I'm a brother from Harlem, grew up in the Wagner Housing Projects. Now I live in the Bronx, but I always tell people I'm from Harlem. I've been arrested before. I do not walk around in fear of the police because when I was arrested, I could do something wrong. It wasn't anything big. It was just a traffic ticket that I didn't pay.
Uh-huh.
But one of the things I didn't notice was when I was asked to step out of the vehicle, I'm 5'10" and 220 pounds, and a lot of guys will look at you and or look at me and say, hey, you're a pretty good-sized guy. And I know when I got out of the car, there was one police car when I was originally stopped, and by the time I was actually asked to get out of the vehicle, there were two other vehicles. Now, I wasn't assaulted by the police officers. They weren't rough with me. They didn't even raise their voices. But what I do know is that when they looked at me stand up, and to me, 5'10" is not really that big. There are some really big guys out there. I could see that look in their eye like, oh, boy, here we go with one of those. One of the things that always worries me about the interactions between people of color and the police is that there is this escalation where you have cops that are already uncomfortable because, frankly speaking, like I said, I'm going through the process now. Most of the guys that I meet are from Long Island. They're from upstate. There's a few guys that are from the city, and mm-hmm. there's a noticeably different attitude
uh-huh.
between the people that I meet that are from the city and the people that are not. So you're already having somebody come into an uncomfortable environment, and then they're dealing with people that they're not familiar with. They're not familiar with right. our mannerisms. They're not familiar with the way we talk and the way we deal with things.
So the training would then need to be different. In addition to the imperative of getting more diversity, more people from the city to police the city, there's the question of how you train people who are less familiar, right?
I think there's that, but I mean, I'm looking at the examples of like Eric Garner. Like, I remember when you did a show, it was a guy that called in from Morristown, and he was commenting on Eric Garner. He says, well, you know, you listen to the police report, and, you know, they say this guy is 6-something and 350 pounds, and you're expecting a sloppy looking guy, and then you see him, he looks like a linebacker. And I'm like, you know, no insult to Eric Garner, but he doesn't look like any linebacker that I know.
Right. Khalif, thank you very much. Robin. Rohan, I should say, in Bridgewater. Rohan, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Yeah, hi. I was charged with resisting arrest from the cops in Bridgewater, and I requested the cops to come because I was accused of shoplifting, and the mall clerks there, they didn't ask me to see my body. They told me, we saw you took this. And I said, you know what? We're not even going to talk. Call the cops. I'll wait until the cops come. Cop came. I thought the cop...
In other words, somebody was accusing you. Right? Rohan, somebody... So to make sure I understand and everybody understand. You were being accused by a shopkeeper of shoplifting, but you asserted that you didn't do it, so you wanted the police to come, correct?
I wanted the cops to come because I was told I stole a coat. You understand me? So it's not a matter of we want to check you or this or that. Is they accused me, said there's a coat on your person or in your bag. And I say, you know what? You're calling me a thief off the back. So I don't want to even communicate with you. I don't want to go through my back. I don't want to deal with you.
Right.
Call the cops.
Got
when the cops come, the cops was like Lord and Taylor security guard. Whatever they wanted, he did. And eventually, it found out. They checked my receipts, five items. I paid for everything. I insisted I wanted a refund. And I went downstairs. They told me to go in the security room. I said, no, I'm not going to no security room. I didn't take anything. I purchased stuff, and I wanted to go to the counter and refund it, get my money back. While in the process of being refunded, I'm standing there. Another cop come. Then another cop is coming. Someone called my phone, and by the time I could say hello, people start screaming at me like I pull a gun out. Get off the phone! Get off the phone! This is an investigation! So I said, am I under arrest? By the time those words come out my mouth, a cop was behind me, attacked me, punched me in the head. I'm down in the back. Of course, I have to, like, defend myself or, like, protect myself. Then the next thing I know, I'm being arrested and I'm resisting arrest.
Did it get dropped?
When they attack you.
Did it get dropped?
They dropped everything.
They did.
They let me go to court, like, 2 times. I pay a lawyer $3,000. And if you don't have money, trust me, they want me to settle. Even the lawyer that I paid $3,000, he's telling me, oh, they want to make it dark. Right. A municipal something ticket just popped to it. And I said, no, I started crying. I couldn't believe this guy paid $3,000 and explained to him that I'm being victimized. He's siding with them and telling me cop to something.
And you're telling me that you didn't cop to something and the charges were dropped.
Right. Eventually they said, oh, we can't locate the cop. We can't locate the cop.
We can't locate the cop. Right. Rohan, thank you very much. And, of course, there's no way to corroborate, you know, a caller's story. I don't know that guy. But it's got the earmarks of the kind of thing that you're reporting on. Here there was allegedly no, according to him, no underlying crime. But the way the contact escalated, he wound up getting charged with resisting arrest, and then they couldn't prove it.
It's pretty consistent with a lot of the stories that I've heard when I was looking into the background of Officer Daniel Pantaleo, the officer involved in the Eric Garner case. I spoke with a number of people that have been arrested by him with the charge of resisting arrest in particular, and a lot of them started as these sort of really minor things that ended up just completely escalating, and that's the case I've seen or heard in a lot of the resisting arrest cases in the city.
Right. So, new numbers crunched by the WNYC data news team on resisting arrest statistics compared by race and by borough for the same underlying crimes. Noah Veltman from our data news team. Where can people see all the stats?
If you just go to WNYC.org, you should see a big link in the corner, and you can see a more detailed analysis.
Noah, thanks a lot. And WNYC criminal justice reporter Robert Lewis. And Robert, people can still hear your whole report from yesterday as well that included the tape of that Queens incident made by the woman as she was being encountered by the police.
Yeah, that's correct. The full report is online, and also in the middle of the web version of the story, there's a link to hear just some a snippet of about 2 minutes of raw audio.
The tape that she made.
That's correct.
While police were at her home. Okay, thank you both very much. Now, what does the Brooklyn DA think about all this? Next, we'll talk to the new Brooklyn District Attorney Ken Thompson, elected last year on a platform of criminal justice reform. Maybe the Garner grand jury would have reached a different conclusion if it was being steered by him rather than Staten Island DA Dan Donovan. Who knows? Ken Thompson next on our family meeting on race and justice. Is this a tipping point? Stay tuned. We'll be right back. It's our family meeting on race and justice. Is this a tipping point? On the Brian Lehrer Show today, last year's elections in New York City were already a tipping point on race and justice. Mayor de Blasio was elected partly on his staunch opposition to Ray Kelly-style stop and frisk. And Ken Thompson unseated longtime Brooklyn DA Charles Hines, running on a platform partly of criminal justice reform. Once in office, he quickly announced that he would stop prosecuting most low-level marijuana cases that the police brought in. The NYPD was behind, but seems to have now come along on that policy. And now, as most progressive voices in New York are calling for a special prosecutor for police brutality cases, Thompson is saying no. He wants those cases for himself as Brooklyn DA. We'll start there. DA Thompson, thanks for crossing county lines and coming to our Lower Manhattan studio. Welcome back to WNYC.
It's my honor to be here. Thank you.
And I think it's fair to say that most people who agree with you on most things want a new special prosecutor law of some kind for alleged police abuse cases, because the DAs work so closely with the police every day, it's seen as a fundamental structural conflict of interest. You don't agree?
Well, no, I don't. I believe that, first of all, I respect New York State Attorney General Eric Schneiderman.
He's got one of the proposals.
Yes.
But he wants to take it.
Yeah, but I disagree with his proposal and similar proposals that would call for having the authority taken away from local prosecutors and given to a special prosecutor to investigate and potentially prosecute police officers who kill an unarmed civilian. You know, as the duly elected district attorney of Brooklyn, I'm more than able to thoroughly and fairly investigate any fatality of an unarmed civilian by a police officer. As a federal prosecutor, I successfully prosecuted along with the attorney general nominee Loretta Lynch, Justin Volpe, for
you worked in
torturing
that
Abner Louima.
Right. You worked in that office under Loretta Lynch, the U.S. attorney's office in Brooklyn, before becoming Brooklyn DA.
Right. And the folks of Brooklyn voted for me to keep them safe from all crimes, including acts of police brutality. And so I ought to be able to, based on my experience, based on the fact that I am the chief law enforcement officer of the third largest DA's office in the country behind Los Angeles and Chicago, with very experienced prosecutors, to prosecute these cases. And I understand it. I get it that people are upset because of Ferguson and because of Garner. I clearly get it. But that doesn't mean that I should be robbed and other local prosecutors of our right to be able to fairly and thoroughly investigate these cases. And you just look at the history of these cases. I just recently indicted two cops in Brooklyn for assaulting a 16-year-old young man named Kareem Tribble, who had his hands up in the air, who was seeking to surrender, and they hit him in the mouth with their gun. Indicted them. I work with the cops, but they crossed the line. Sean Bell, Judge Brown in Queens, indicted those officers. Rob Johnson, up in the Bronx, indicted the officers in the Amadou Diallo case. And so we have examples. And so I want people to understand that, yes, we need to look at criminal justice reforms, but I don't agree that the answer is taking these cases from the 62 district attorneys around the state and investing this powerful authority in one special prosecutor.
One problem here that the people on the other side of this question point out is that the office of district attorney is elected, so there is incentive to cater to public opinion. On Staten Island, we know who the electorate is. Maybe Dan Donovan led that grand jury to its non-indictment because he's being responsive to his core constituency, maybe. Maybe your core constituency in Brooklyn is different, and you want to make a show of the fact that you can indict police officers. Maybe that's no less compromised a position to start from, though, on hot-button police abuse cases. Why shouldn't my listeners be concerned about that?
Brian, I don't want, and I don't think any DA wants to make an example of police officers. Our duty is to do justice and to be fair to civilians and to the police. The proposals that are being floated are not really workable. For instance, the Attorney General of the state of New York is elected as well every 4 years. He just got reelected, right?
But that's only one of the – I know Eric Schneiderman is saying give it to me.
I'm aware of
– another form is that the governor or somebody could appoint an independent special prosecutor in these hot-button cases.
But the problem with it is this. We have 62 counties in the state. So first of all, it will signal that you can't trust local prosecutors to handle these cases. There's something about us where you just can't trust us. So you have to take these cases and put it in the hands of someone else. I disagree with that.
But it's not you. It's the structure. And it's the perception of conflict of interest because prosecutors and district attorneys work with the police so closely every single day to get the jobs done.
Well, let me just say this. Let me go back to the point you made in terms of if it's just put in the hands of a special prosecutor who's appointed by the governor. How is that going to work, Brian? If there's a shooting up in Buffalo, New York, a young unarmed guy is killed by the police up there. Special prosecutor is supposed to swoop down and deal with it. But what happens if something breaks out in Brooklyn a week later and then breaks out in Syracuse? How is this person supposed to tell the folks up in Buffalo, hold on, I'll be back. I've got to go to the I got to go to Brooklyn. It's not.
Maybe it would be a different special prosecutor.
So, okay, let me ask you this. The argument that they're making is the reason whether it's going to be put in the hands of the duly elected New York State Attorney General or someone who the governor appoints is because the rationale is because you can't really trust us. We work too closely with these police officers. Then why is it that the proposal is really just to take a small subset of cases? Use of deadly force on someone who was unarmed. Why not? If you can't trust me and my 61 other colleagues in the state to handle police brutality cases, then take them all from us. Why should I be able to go into the grand jury like I did and indict those two police officers for assaulting that young 16-year-old boy in Brooklyn? If you can't trust me, then take them all from me and take them all from every DA.
Them all meaning all police-oriented? All police,
every act of police brutality in the state. It is unworkable, Brian. Let me also ask you this. Who decides if somebody was unarmed? Who makes that threshold determination? Because there's often instances when there's a factual dispute. People in the community say that person did not have a gun. And the officers say they did. And there's a gun on the scene. Who makes the determination if the person was armed or unarmed? Is it the DA or is it the special prosecutor?
All right. Listeners, is Brooklyn DA Ken Thompson convincing you that a special prosecutor law is not needed in the case of, as Governor Cuomo's framing is, killings of unarmed people by the police as a matter of structural reform? This is becoming one of the things that advocates for police reform are putting at the tops of their list. Here is an advocate of police reform who was elected last year to be Brooklyn DA, Ken Thompson. He's saying, no, this is part of my job. I want to keep this job. Is he convincing you? 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And we'll take a few phone calls on this. We're not going to make our whole interview about this. And so as people are calling in, DA Thompson, in general terms, as the old saying goes, do you think a DA can indict a ham sandwich?
I think a DA, an experienced DA, should be able to present evidence to a grand jury in a fair way and seek an indictment. I mean, if someone committed a crime, there should be ample evidence that you bring into the grand jury. The grand jury is made up of people from the community. They may disagree.
That's ideally. In reality, are they putty in your hands?
I wouldn't say that they're putty in our hands because grand jurors ask questions. They just don't sit there as some folks think. Obviously, there is concern because of what has happened over the last couple of weeks with respect to high-profile grand juries. But I think we do a disservice to the folks who serve on grand juries to think that they are sort of like at the beck and call and have no say. I think that's unfair, and I don't think that's accurate.
The saying implies, obviously, that DAs can also non-indict a ham sandwich. Do you think that's what happened in the death of Eric Garner?
You know, Brian, I can't comment on what happened in that grand jury because I wasn't in it, and I have the utmost respect for all my colleagues in the state. I don't know what happened, and I think that people are upset, and I get it, I understand it, but I can't comment on what happened. I can only control what happens in Brooklyn.
Having seen the videotape, do you think personally that justice was done in that case?
I'm not sure. I have to say, the looking at the video gives me concern. I mean, as a person, gives me concern.
Do you think that grand jury might have come to a different conclusion under a different DA?
Brian, I can't say that because I don't know all the evidence that was presented to the grand jury. I mean, apparently there were many witnesses who went in, and there were many pieces of exhibits introduced to that grand jury. So I can't say if you take that grand jury and you transfer them to Brooklyn or the Bronx or Queens, it would have been a different result.
What'd you think of the Ferguson prosecutor's news conference? A lot of people thought he sounded more like a defense attorney than a prosecutor. That's part of what raised this new outcry for an independent prosecutor in such cases.
I didn't agree with the way he went about it, per se, because I think that there were deep-rooted pockets of resentment in that community. And I think that particular case just brought all of that to the forefront. And I think that prosecutor there were a lot of accusations made against that prosecutor in terms of whether that prosecutor could be fair based on his personal history of his father being killed by a father who was a police officer being killed in a line of duty. And so I can't really criticize totally because I didn't walk in his shoes. All I'm saying is that clearly there is something wrong in Ferguson. Clearly there's something wrong in this country, and we need to do things better. We need to understand that there is a history of cases in which people have been killed or died, and the community feels that there was no justice. Just in New York, there's a litany of cases from Eleanor Bumpers to Anthony Byers, to Patrick Dorsman, to Sean Bell, to Amadou Diallo. Going back to 1973 with Clifford Glover, a 10-year-old boy shot in his back by police officer Thomas Shea. You got Randy Evans, and now you have Eric Gardner.
Hardly any indictments or prosecution, or I should say convictions, in any of those cases that you just listed from New York history. Is something structurally wrong?
Well, I have to say this. I think that the governor is right when he says that he is going to convene a comprehensive review of our criminal practice here in the state.
Don't we already know after 40 years of those cases you just listed?
I think that we can do better. I think that people misunderstand the grand secrecy, the purpose of the grand secrecy with the grand jury. I was at a community event and there was an elected official, you know, before I got there, describing the grand jury, and the way they described it, it was so sinister. You know, I thought they were going to say the DA is the boogeyman. I mean, it was just... So I had to explain to this group that the purpose of the grand jury secrecy is to protect people. Because if Miss Jones sees somebody selling drugs on the corner and they call the police and the police make that arrest, Miss Jones should be able to go into the grand jury and testify about that without doing it publicly and then going home and trying to have a nice night's sleep.
But in the Ferguson case, the prosecutor held a big news conference afterwards and he released so much transcript material of testimony to the grand jury. Here, I know the law is different in New York State, but DA Dan Donovan didn't even ask the court to release a lot of transcript of testimony, even by the police officer. Should he have asked for more? Would you have asked for more?
Brian, you have to ask Dan Donovan that. What I would say is, in order to restore public confidence in our criminal justice system, I support releasing the transcript of grand jury proceedings involving police fatalities. Once the grand jury has completed its work, so long as the court oversees the process to ensure that witnesses are protected, because a delicate balance must be maintained between the importance of protecting grand jury secrecy and the trust that people must have in the fairness of our criminal justice system. I'm saying that for me, Ken Thompson, Brooklyn DA.
Let's take a few phone calls for Ken Thompson, Brooklyn DA. Larry in Bed-Stuy, you're on WNYC. Hello, Larry.
Hi, Hi, good morning, Ryan. Thanks so much for taking my call.
Thank you.
I first want to say I'm a supporter of D.A. Thompson, and I've supported his campaign, but I feel like you are very wrong on this particular point. And I think your inability, one, as a D.A., but two, as a D.A. of African descent, your inability to clearly say that what we saw happen in Ferguson, what we all saw happen on that videotape to Eric Gardner, it was a crime that should have been prosecuted and should have led to an indictment. Your inability to say that without the equivocation now, even after what we've seen, is part of the reason there is a distrust from the community and its ability to trust local offices to prosecute these cases. And if we don't recognize that history and the fact that the history of the laws that protect police officers have their roots in laws that protected white slave owners who happened to kill their slaves in the while meeting out punishment,
The president of the United States also said, you have to respect the individual grand jury and the individual process because you weren't in the room. You haven't seen all the evidence. You're ready to go way beyond that, and you want all our elected officials to say, no, they got it wrong?
I want our elected officials, especially those who are of African descent and who know better. And quite frankly, President Obama knows better, and he knows what's really going on. I expect our elected officials, those who come from the black community, who are elected to represent the interests of the black community, to speak up and speak truth to power when racism and institutionalized racism is marginalizing us in the process, and they are more concerned about protecting their jobs and future advancements than they are speaking and giving voice to the people who do not have access to that microphone on their own.
Lurie, thank you. D.A. Thompson.
Lurie, let me just say this. I understand your concern. When I looked at the video, like everybody else did, I was concerned. Eric Gardner repeatedly said that he could not breathe. And so it is difficult for me to then jump to the conclusion that the grand jury was completely, you know, wrong or you know, they didn't want... I wasn't in the grand jury. If I was over the grand jury, I would be able to speak more knowledgeably. I think that, I said, I completely get it why people are upset. It's difficult for me to sit here as the Brooklyn DA and throw rocks at another DA who had that case, who had all the evidence. I had none of it. I watched the video. I was concerned. I have a young child. A young son who's 8 years old. And so I am clear as the Brooklyn DA that we need to change things. And again, I am the DA who indicted the cops, who beat that boy in Crown Heights, who had his hands up. And so you have to give me a chance to handle the cases that are before me. I'm here and I'm speaking honestly. We need to change things, and I definitely think that we need to make our grand jury system maybe somewhat more transparent. I'll give you an example. We have to protect witnesses, undercover agents who go on the grand jury, people who see crimes in their neighborhoods. We have to protect them. So we can't have these public sort of inquisitions where anyone can walk in a courtroom and hear people testify. We also have to protect innocent people who may be under investigation, who had done absolutely nothing wrong. Why should they be disparaged to the community? They can never get their good name back. But at the same time, we have to be able to explain to the community why a decision like in Gardner occurred, because the community needs answers. And so I support amending the law so we can give answers.
You announced formation of a grand jury in the stairwell shooting of a Kai Gurley in a NYCHA building in East New York. Why in that case, which police say appeared to be an accidental discharge, he wasn't even meaning to fire his weapon, we're told he just pulled it out, which I guess they're allowed to do on routine patrol going into a stairwell in a NYCHA building, and they say it accidentally went off. Why is that rising to the level of appointing a grand jury?
An innocent man was killed. An innocent man who had done nothing wrong lost his life. All he was doing was walking down the staircase, which is not a crime. An innocent man whose 2-year-old daughter will grow up without her father lost his life. When the statements were made that it was an accident, it was right after it occurred, and I get that. But we have to do an investigation. And I believe I have an obligation to the people of Brooklyn to do a thorough and fair investigation. And the best way to do it is by way of a grand jury. And so I have no hesitation. I'm going into the grand jury, and I'm going to present the evidence. It's going to be a fair investigation, fair to the police officers involved, but fair also to Akai Gurley and his family.
Could there be something wrong with the policy? Should police not be allowed to patrol with weapons drawn without even a threat that they think they're encountering at a particular moment?
You know, Brian, that's a good question, because you're talking to someone who was raised in public housing, part of my life. It's raised by a single mother in what we used to call the projects. And because my mother sacrificed her life for me and my brother and sister, became a New York City police officer in the early 70s when there were no women on the street. She changed my life.
And it was a much more dangerous time.
Yes, and she gave me a chance. And the reason why I raise that is because the vast majority of people who live in public housing are hardworking, law-abiding folks. And so I look at people who live there like when I lived there with my family. And I understand the concerns about danger and crime, but there's some hardworking folks in there, and there's children running around as well.
So you want them to look at that policy. You're not calling for a change, per se.
I'm not calling for a change. It's just, as the Brooklyn DA, someone who was raised in public housing, I think I have a different take.
In general, DA Thompson, is this a tipping point? That's the title of our special show today.
Yes.
Or could this be a tipping point for race and justice in New York or the United States because there is so much focus now on these issues?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, look, when I did the Abner Louima trial with Loretta Lynch, that was many years ago, you had a New York City police officer, Brian, who dragged a helpless, badly beaten man who was handcuffed behind his back into the bathroom of the 78th Precinct and sodomized that man with a broken broomstick, literally ripped up his intestines, almost killed him. And we held him accountable under great pressure. I don't think that going from episode to episode and people get upset and people protest is necessarily the way to do it. There's got to be systemic change in how we handle these cases. There's got to be systemic change in terms of we've got to protect the grand jury secrecy, but we have to acknowledge that people have a right to understand when these fatalities happen, what occurred in the grand jury. Because if not, then people is going to erode the trust, and we need the public's trust in law enforcement, because if we don't have it, it is not going to work. And so for me, I'm fair, and I'm going to take this Akai Gurley matter into the grand jury because it's going to be a fair presentation, and the people of Brooklyn have to decide.
Maybe you heard the reporting from our last segment on how often the police bring resisting arrest charges against blacks in the city compared to whites stopped for the same original violation, usually low-level violations. And we played the tape of an example of a couple in Queens, both arrested for resisting arrest over the underlying violation of his riding a bicycle on the sidewalk in front of his own house. The charges were later dropped, and one of the officers was found to have acted improperly by the department. Have you been aware of this pattern of different rates of resisting arrest for the same underlying charges when there's contact with blacks as opposed to others? And is it something that you can look at as the Brooklyn DA when deciding whether to prosecute resisting arrest charges when police bring in cases like this?
There's something that we certainly can look at. There's something that we may look at.
And in your opinion, is there just too much contact between the police and low-income black and Latino New Yorkers over too many small things? Is that an underlying cause of all of this? You came in and you changed the policy on when you would prosecute low-level marijuana crimes. That was historic, and that seemed to bring the NYPD along a few months later. Is it even bigger than that?
I think that there is a gulf of distrust between many communities and the police who patrol them. And I think if the community if we do not have the respect of the community as law enforcement, we're going to have these situations that are going to explode, and we're going to be dealing, going from crisis to crisis. And so I am determined to not only keep the people of Brooklyn safe, but also to make sure that there's equal justice for all, make sure that there's fundamental fairness in the criminal justice system. And I am just getting started.
He is just getting started, nearing the end of his first year in office as Brooklyn District Attorney. Ken Thompson, thank you very much for giving us so much time this morning. We really appreciate it.
Thank you
for your openness
me.
To all these questions from me and our listeners. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you, Brian.
And we'll talk again.
Yes.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. It's our family meeting on race and justice today. Is this a tipping point? And could it be a tipping point for solutions in the battle for better community police relations rather than just finger pointing? My next guest has been working to repair this relationship for over two decades. He's David Kennedy, the head of the Center for Crime Prevention at John Jay College, and the author of Don't Shoot, One Man, A Street Fellowship, and The End of Violence in Inner City America. Professor David Kennedy, welcome to WNYC.
Morning, Brian.
So I see that you're heading up with $5 million in grant money, what you call the National Initiative for Building Community Trust and Justice. What is it?
That is a Department of Justice initiative. It's the biggest thing in this world, this official world, in the actually 30 years I've been doing this. And it is the recognition by the Justice Department of what D.A. Thompson just said, that if we don't fix the broken trust issue, everything else is going to fail.
I'm going to play some tape from a story you told at the Race in America conference at the University of Pittsburgh in 2010. I think this is going to speak for itself.
A man in his probably late 20s, early 30s, who said, I got stopped in my neighborhood, and they were running the wants and warrants on me. And the cop said, have you ever been arrested? And I said, no, I've never been arrested. And he laughed at me. And then the wants and warrants came back, and in fact, the guy was clean. Let him go. Those of you who think he got an apology, please raise your hand.
That was you telling that story?
That was me.
So, tell us more about that, and what was the moral of that story?
So the moral is that, and again, D.A. Thompson said, we cannot keep on lurching from incident to incident. That's absolutely right. Let's pretend for a second that there had been no killings recently and we were not focused on these incidents and this indictment and this grand jury and this special prosecutor. Let's forget about all that for a minute. It would still be the case that in especially black neighborhoods all over the country, there is a profoundly broken relationship between those neighborhoods and law enforcement. The thing I have most learned from working with those neighborhoods is that when there is an incident, the white folks and the authorities focus on the incident, and the neighborhood focuses on history. And what they are most of anything saying is sort of under everything else, why do you keep doing this to us? And it's not just the killings. It's the historical legacy of transportation and slavery and slave catching and Jim Crow and Reconstruction and the Black Codes and the FBI conspiring to get Martin Luther King to commit suicide and Separate But Equal and Dred Scott and on and on and on and on and on. And in the modern era, especially of policing, it is a law enforcement structure that means one in three black men go to prison, 70% of black men who don't finish college go to prison. It is the routine experience in these places that the black young man, which I think was not in the clip, gets stopped over and over and over and over again. They are disrespected. Hands are put on them. And if there were no bodies to address at all of that would still be true.
So listeners How do we bridge that gap? If you're white, if you're black, if you're in law enforcement, if you're a civilian, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Let's have this conversation in the spirit of the name of David Kennedy's initiative called the National Initiative for Building Community Trust and Justice, 212-433-WNYC. And this is WNYC FM HD and AM New York, WNJT FM 88.1 Trenton, WNJP 88.5 Sussex, WNJY 89.3 Netcong, and WNJO 90.3 Toms River, New York and New Jersey Public Radio. So what's the next step toward an actual solution that changes something so we don't lurch from incident to incident if we have these different perceptions? If whites in general, and maybe if the police, most importantly, are just looking at the incident, and black Americans tend to be looking at it in the context of all of that broad sweep of, you know, the racist history in America, and say, why do you keep doing this to us? Does it mean police do their jobs any different when they're in the middle of an individual situation, other than obviously not laughing at somebody who claims that he doesn't have a criminal record when in fact he doesn't?
Yep, those small things actually turn out to help a lot. They won't fix things, but they do matter. So, again, I don't believe that simply changing our reaction to individual incidents, lethal or non-lethal, we of course we have to do that. That won't fix it. And a lot of us believe, I very strongly believe, that the first and biggest thing that law enforcement can do, and let's call this what it is. Of course there is race infused all through this. But 20 years ago, we all thought that if police departments reflected their cities demographically, that this problem would take care of itself.
And New York, unlike Ferguson, is making a fair amount of progress in that direction.
And others have, in fact, made more because they're smaller. We have actually very solid research on all black police departments in relationship with their black communities. And these problems are just as bad. So, yes, of course, this is about race. But more fundamentally, it is about the relationship between America and the power of the state being applied to black America. And the police are the most visible frontline part of that, but they're not the only part. And a lot of what the police are wearing now, they didn't make it happen. They may have been feeding the system that puts all these black men in prison, but they didn't write those laws. But what we really need to do is face the fact that this is not about incidents. It's not about just what's happening now. It is about what's gone on literally from colonial times forward. We have never really faced it. We have never really named it. The police are, in a way, in a remarkable place to take the lead on this. And both in the abstract and we're seeing this happen in practice, what I think really needs to happen is that police need to go to these neighborhoods, police leadership, and say, we get it. We're sorry. People wearing this uniform did you terrible damage. We haven't done so well since the civil rights laws changed.
A very general apology for 50 years of police work?
Where'd 50 years come from? We're talking about 300 years.
Civil rights, Civil Rights Act. Yes, of course.
Gary McCarthy, who's ex-NYPD and the superintendent of police in Chicago, is going into the angriest black neighborhoods in Chicago and saying police wearing this uniform enforce the racist laws of the United States. And we've done wrong things since then as well. And cops will say, I wasn't there. I didn't do that. And they're right. Cops today are actually not really – racism is not the problem with current policing. But you have to own your institution. You can't say, I'm a proud member of the Chicago Police Department, but everything that happened before 1963 doesn't count.
But did you just say that racism is not the problem with police work today?
I did.
Because?
because cops today are not racist the way they were in 1955 and 1855. Is there racism in the agencies? Of course there is. There's racism everywhere. But you know, this city is a great example. When 18 months ago, New York police officers were stopping nearly 800,000 mostly young black men a year in this city, it wasn't because they were racist. It was because they were being told to. And now they've been told not to, and it's down by almost 90%. That's not a racism problem. That's a management and strategy and priorities problem.
But at the same time, people are still upset over Bratton-style policing, which may not be Kelly-style stop and frisk, but it's still broken windows with so many small incident contacts over minor infractions. And do you think that broken windows policing is incompatible with that historical apology you just articulating and understanding the history? Because the history is stopping a lot of innocent or mostly innocent African Americans for doing not much, and it may feel like that is happening today.
Well, I'm enough of a social science geek to want to draw a distinction between broken windows, which is a good and honorable idea, and zero tolerance, which is an abomination. Zero tolerance is incompatible with any civilized approach to any community.
And broken windows?
Broken windows is about the police having a role in promoting order and civility in communities, and that's a good thing. Do you do it by stopping everything that moves? No.
David Kennedy from the John Jay College of Criminal Justice, heading up the National Initiative for Building Community Trust and Justice, funded by the U.S. Justice Department, and Gibbs in Greenwich Village. You're on WNYC with Professor Kennedy. Hello, Gibbs.
Oh, thanks very much for taking my call. I'm a psychoanalyst. I've specialized in crisis intervention for 50 years. I've worked with addicts and so forth. I believe the issue also is not racism. I think the issue is relationships. And I think the problem with the police thing, and it's interesting that this problem is also involved in the concern about rapes and concern about unjust wars and so forth. This is an endemic problem that is hitting us on all fronts. What's the issue? We are skirting symptoms rather than causes. What's the cause? The cause is finding some way to have effective crisis intervention. What do you have to intervene with? What's really the nub of it? The attitude of both whoever's involved to adrenaline, fear, excitement, and anxiety. My proposal is, I wrote a manual for first responders called Attitude Shifting, in which policemen, anybody who feels that somebody is suffering from an overreaction to anxiety, the key to success is teaching oneself and whomever you're dealing with how to bear increasing dosages of frustration.
Gibbs, I'm going to leave it there. He raises an important concept, I think, for tense situations between police and community members.
He does. And then I want to draw a distinction between that and everything else. But so what you just heard is exactly right. One of the planks in the DOJ initiative is attention to what's called implicit bias, which is, again, not racism, but bad habits of mind that all of us can develop and, in fact, do develop. And my colleague Phil Goff from UCLA, who's driving this, has discovered, for example, that if departments are told that as a matter of standard policy, the person who has been leading the foot chase doesn't make the first use of force decision, but the next officer in line does, that things go much better, right? And so there are a lot of very common sense things we can do around this. But again, the...
Meaning when use of force is justified.
When use of force is being decided upon, you don't want the most adrenalized officer making that decision. Exactly right. But just to say it again, the foot chases, the shootings, the shoot-don't-shoot decisions, they're a tenth of a percent of police work. And what our angry communities with broken trust, and again, the caller said it's about relationships, the DA said it, I'm saying it, DOJ is saying it. If we don't reshape the everyday encounters and the everyday relationships between police and these communities. We'll never deal with this by dealing with the extreme incidents.
And does it go both ways? We've been addressing how police need to change in police-community relations. One instance that you're familiar with, or one city, I should say, is High Point, North Carolina, which is often cited as the paradigm for repaired police-community relations after instituting one of your programs, the Group Violence Reduction Strategy. And essentially, residents of the nonprofit High Point Community Against Violence, that group, act as middlemen between the police and residents. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
I can, but I'm actually only going to focus on one piece, because in High Point, and not just in High Point, but in lots of places, we actually know quite a lot now about how to reset these relationships. And does the community have a role to play? Of course it does. Do they need to change? Of course they do. I'm not going to talk about that, because if we're looking at the scales of balance here and pretend that the responsibility of the state here is the same as the responsibility of the community, we have got this fundamentally wrong.
False equivalency.
It's an absolute false equivalency.
The responsibility of the state is much greater.
It's overwhelmingly larger. It did the damage. It has to move first.
Let's take another call. Michael in Newark, you're on WNYC. Hello, Michael.
Hi, guys. I wanted to make the point that I think one of the large causes of the divide between the police and community members is that the police seem to be an increasingly militarized and aggressive force. I'm told by older members of my family that there was a time when you could see a police officer, during the week in uniform, and then you could see him on the weekend at the grocery store or at church, and he was part of your, he was part of your community. But now, you get police officers that they're heavily armored, they got bulletproof vests on, and they feel like occupiers or stormtroopers, and it's hard for community members to really react with them in a constructive way. Maybe that's the way I feel, but it seems that is at least a symptom of a larger issue. The fact that police don't feel like they're on your level.
Michael, thank you. He really raises two issues there. One is how armed police officers are, and I think President Obama just addressed this recently, the kind of militarization of urban police forces. And the other that Michael suggests is that police don't live in the communities that they're policing in so many cases.
So, right on both counts. And by way of very clear remedy on this, we can look, for example, to the Neighborhood Safety Initiative in Los Angeles, where in what remains the most troubled part of the most troubled area of LA, the housing projects in Watts and South Los Angeles, police officers trained by Connie Rice's advancement project were given permanent assignments to live and work in those housing projects. I have walked them. They're some of the scariest places I've ever been. LAPD occupied them because that's all it could imagine how to do. And 5 years into this, they are dramatically better. The officers are there. They're not rotated out. They're essentially permanently on site. They get to know people. They know the 1% who are troubled from the 99% who aren't, as the DA just said. They are being very, very, very effective, and they're effective because they are now a known part of that community.
You said earlier that even in instances where the police department is all black in a mostly black community, the same kinds of police community incidents tend to occur at about the same rate. So the problem is policing, not where the officers come from. So do you think residency requirements and pushes for diversity on the force, or a force that looks like the community, are utterly irrelevant?
I think they're not nearly as relevant as we think they are. And again, if we think that we're going to solve these issues by changing the places that cops live, we are just missing the point.
Is this potentially a tipping point? That's the framing of our show today, with so much focus. And you came in here saying, forget about Ferguson for the moment. Forget about Staten Island for the moment. We need to, you know, calm down and look at these underlying structures if we're going to actually change anything. But could this be a tipping point to bring about the kinds of reforms that you've been studying and proposing for years now, because there is so much focus?
I certainly fervently hope so. So I think we're really on a knife edge here. And part of the pain for a lot of us in watching what's been going on these last months is, if you are close to law enforcement, you know that law enforcement is much better than we are seeing right now. There is tremendous openness in the business. People understand they need to change. They understand they can't arrest their way out of these issues. This commitment to legitimacy, as the field calls it, and rebuilding these trust relationships has been gathering steam on its own in the field for years now. And if you know about what's going on the ground all around the country, you can see the examples of ways in which we can do dramatically better. And the Justice Department initiative is partly about pulling those threads together and weaving something new out of them. And there's really reason to be optimistic about that. The other side is, we are very good in this area, both communities and police departments, of judging one another according to the worst things that we do. And we're in that cycle right now. The potential for this to be deeply, permanently destructive is also very high.
David Kennedy, he's the head of the Center for Crime Prevention at John Jay College and author of Don't Shoot, One Man, A Street Fellowship, and the End of Violence in Inner City America, as well as heading up the Justice Department's National Initiative for Building Community Trust and Justice. Thank you for your work and for coming in.
Thanks.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. On our family meeting here on the Brian Lehrer Show today, race and justice, is this a tipping point? We'll continue with historian Jelani Cobb to talk about other possible tipping points from the past and where today connects. Stay with us, Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. It's our family meeting on race and justice. Is this a tipping point? And with us now is New Yorker writer and University of Connecticut historian Jelani Cobb. His piece in the December 4th New Yorker was called No Such Thing as Racial Profiling. Jelani, thanks for coming on and welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you. It's good to be back.
When I asked the question, is this a tipping point? As a historian, do you feel like we've been here before with moments of galvanized attention on race and the police?
Unfortunately, we have been. And even to the point where now you can kind of see a pattern. You can, you know, note how these things tend to play out. And, you know, so in, 1967, the Kerner Commission, as some of the listeners are familiar with, was formed to get at the roots of the unrest that was racking American cities.
This is the LBJ administration after a lot of urban unrest in the 1960s. They formed what was called the Kerner Commission, right?
Right. And in particular, and that, you know, that commission, you can find that report online. It's not really hard to find. And, you know, the commission, you know, looks into this is, you know, after the major uprisings that happened in Detroit and the other in Newark in 1967. But there were literally dozens of others that had already taken place, much smaller scale, but had taken place throughout the country. And so, you know, there was a commission that was formed, you know, generated a report about a year later. It said that, among other things, you know, there needed to be better grievance recognition processes dealing with, you know, the ghetto, as they used that terminology then. We'd now say, you know, something different. But they said, you know, we need to have better grievances and we need to have better lines of communication and so on, and then kind of, you know, went on. And, you know, after the 1992 Los Angeles riots that, you know, came in the wake of the Rodney King verdict, the verdict that the officer is accused of, charged with beating Rodney King, there was the Christopher Commission. And that commission looked into, you know, the, you know, problems within the LAPD and came down with the famous, you know, few bad apples analysis of what had happened there, and, you know, said there needed to be, you know, kind of more rigorous training, and people needed to have rooted out this small number of people who were really giving the department itself a black eye. And so looking now, we have a, you know, a Ferguson Commission that was created by Governor Jay Nixon. We also have a federal commission that was created by President Obama dealing with these things. But it seems that, you know, we reach flashpoints and then we have a bureaucratic response to them. And then we come up with a bureaucratic solution, which does not seem necessarily adequate to the task of at least permanently resolving these kinds of problems.
So with nearly 50 years of a track record now, do you think the Kerner Commission, to take that historical example, that after what was supposed to be a tipping point, did it accomplish anything significant?
Well, you know, I shouldn't even say it's a 50-year example because there are commissions earlier than that. Those are just the most notable ones, and commissions specifically in response to urban unrest.
Right.
And, you know, I think that the problem, you know, lies in seeing the immediate cause, you know, of these instances. All of them, mind you, were related to instances of police brutality. And that's what happened in Newark. That's what happened in Detroit. That was what happened in Watts. That was what happened in Harlem in 1964. That was what happened with Rodney King in 1992. I mean, all of those things were connected to directly to police relationships with communities and excessive use of force. And, you know, in mind, obviously, what happened in Ferguson as well. But it's wrong to think of this as simply a policing problem. We don't typically deliver services well to poor people, especially not poor communities of color, on any level, on any of the institutions. Our educational systems tend not to, certainly not the, you know, housing, you know, our system for producing housing for people who are low income or people who are in predominantly communities of color. And, you know, the policing just being the most literally physical contact that people have with institutions that have tended not to function well already. So understanding that is much more key to understanding simply matters of police relations. And that is a much bigger project. And I don't think that any of these commissions, well, Kerner did somewhat, but I don't think any of these commissions have ever really gone to the heart of what it would take to really address those problems because they touch on such multifaceted issues in the society at large.
Jelani Cobb with us from The New Yorker and the University of Connecticut. In your December 4th article, you printed transcripts of some things that President Obama, former basketball player Charles Barkley, and former Mayor Rudy Giuliani have said. And since this is radio, we get to play the audio of some of those quotes, and I'd like to give you the chance to comment on them here. So, for example, I'll read the first one. This is President Obama's remarks after the non-indictment of George Zimmerman in the death of Trayvon Martin. And President Obama said, "The death of Trayvon Martin was a tragedy, not just for his family or for any one community, but for America. I know this case has elicited strong passions, and in the wake of the verdict, I know those passions may be running even higher. But we are a nation of laws, and a jury has spoken. I now ask every American to respect the call for calm reflection from two parents who lost their young son." So that was Obama after George Zimmerman. Here's Obama the other week after Ferguson.
"First and foremost, we are a nation built on the rule of law. And so we need to accept that this decision was the grand jury's to make. There are Americans who agree with it, and there are Americans who are deeply disappointed, even angry. It's an understandable reaction. But I join Michael's parents in asking anyone who protests this decision to do so peacefully."
So he would have been accused of plagiarism were they not his words in the first place right. After Trayvon Martin. What point were you trying to make by showing how close the president's statements were after George Zimmerman non-conviction and after the Ferguson non-indictment?
Well, you could also include the Sean Bell. He made an almost identical statement after Sean Bell when he was running for president, and the officers involved in his shooting death were acquitted. And he made a similar statement regarding Eric Garner. And so there's a kind of persistent echo and almost valorization of process, not necessarily outcome. But the inherent contradiction in the statement that the president was making is that people are upset precisely because this is supposed to be a nation of laws. It's not simply saying that the nation of laws pertains to a jury coming to a conclusion that people find disagreeable, but it's saying, you know, does the law itself provide for citizens to be killed under highly ambiguous or at least ambivalent circumstances? And looking at it charitably, and there is no legal recompense. And so people are protesting precisely because this is supposed to be a nation of laws.
So let me play some of what the president did say after the Eric Garner, Officer Pantaleo non-indictment. And he seems to go a little bit further. And I wonder if you think that he is starting to step out into some kind of leadership role, as people have been asking him to do, people such as yourself. Listen to 45 seconds of Obama after the Garner and Police Officer Pantaleo non-indictment.
Some of you may have heard there was a decision that came out today by a grand jury not to indict police officers who had interacted with an individual named Eric Garner in New York City, all of which was caught on videotape and speaks to the larger issues that we've been talking about now for the last week, the last month, the last year, and sadly, for decades. And that is the concern on the part of too many minority communities that law enforcement is not working with them and dealing with them in a fair way.
So do you hear the president any differently there? Do you think something is starting to change in his language? And might he step out yet and use the last 2 years of his administration, now that he's not running for re-election anymore, et cetera, to help lead a different kind of conversation?
Perhaps. I think that's possible. That would be, you know, a great outcome. But I'm hesitant to read too much into it because the president's language has generally been – on matters of race, been very even-handed, even to the point of maybe false even-handedness in his rhetoric. And so this was also the only comment that he made in which he did not appeal to the rule of law. I should have pointed that earlier, that out earlier. But I don't know that that might be indicative of a broader shift. Certainly he just made the comments about Ferguson, I guess, a week or 10 days earlier. And people were very critical about them, thinking that they were kind of milquetoast, given what it had, the nature of what had happened. So they may have just been a rhetorical shift. It may bring a different kind of approach in his last 2 years, but I'm not prepared to say that I think that it's indicative of that just yet.
Phyllis in Montclair, you're on WNYC with Jelani Cobb from The New Yorker and the University of Connecticut. Hi, Phyllis. Phyllis, are you there?
Yes.
Hi.
Thank you. I wanted to address this discussion of making changes that improve our society. And reason I feel there's a systemic problem between blacks and whites is that as a society, we are infected with the lie that blacks are inferior. And I wanted to illustrate that with a recent story a black woman told me when she went in to a nice store for women's clothing. She was nicely dressed, and as she entered, the store's greeter looked at her and tensed up and looked apprehensive and went over to greet the white woman shopper who came in right behind the black woman. And this woman told me how badly it made her feel, and it wasn't the only time that she experienced this differential. So I'm thinking of that song in South Pacific that says, you have to be carefully taught. And this woman, this teacher in Rice Elementary School in Iowa carried out an experiment and divided her class, and half of them were called the brown eyes and the other the blue eyes. And the inferior feeling that came over those who were designated as brown eyes was dramatic. This is a documentary and film.
And Phyllis, I'm going to leave it there. Those are very powerful anecdotes. And Professor Cobb, I wonder if you think the conversation that we're all having now is a little bit too narrow, as Phyllis suggests. Are we looking, you know, under the microscope too much at police policy rather than looking at larger questions of racism in America?
I think that's what Ferguson taught us, or what it should have taught us. You know, we looked at Ferguson in the initial reports and thought this was a case of an unarmed person being shot by a police officer. And the relevant details were encapsulated in that, you know, the basic chronology of what happened between them. But when you looked beneath it, you saw, you know, questions of, you know, the black population increasing in this community while their political representation. You saw matters of basically poor people becoming a source of revenue for the county, you know, by the use of traffic tickets that were disproportionately targeting their communities. You saw matters of education policy that were there. Matters of enfranchisement. And so, I mean, all of these things that went together, and those were the context. The context was just as damning as anything that could have happened on Canfield Drive between Darren Wilson and Michael Brown that afternoon.
Ed on Staten Island, you're on WNYC. Hi, Ed.
Hello. I just listening to both your guests, I start to question whether social scientists are really going back to a playbook that is 50 or 30 years ago and ignoring the fact, well, at least with the NYPD today, we are dealing with a minority police department, and we are dealing with things that they are still filtering things through a department in their mind that is, you know, lily white, for lack of a better term. And, you know, the reality is, I think when I hear all this about race, it seems there are a lot of problems between people in their, you know, racial relations, economic situations. And so often the police are blamed for this. And the argument I'm making to you is there have been a tremendous amount of changes. The NYPD has ridiculous supervision by anybody's standards. When you think about, you have an IG, CCRB, Internal Affairs, Federal Oversight, DAs looking at it. I mean, there's so many people looking at it. How can any problem exist? But the reality is, what happens is when people do the wrong thing, they're disciplined. And, you know, I would just have to say, you know, whatever your beliefs are about race and the interaction of different races in our country, you really have to look at the police department. It's an amazingly diverse entity. The Garner family themselves has said that they didn't believe race was a factor in what happened. There was a black supervisor on the scene, and they were ordered to go there by Chief Philip Banks, who was also black. And I just don't understand that these things don't fall into the argument that your social scientists make.
Jelani Cobb?
Mm-hmm. So, first, I didn't hear what the previous guest said, but that's not what my contention was. I think that would be a simplistic way of responding to the issue at hand. And it's unfortunate. There was also a black officer present when Sean Bell was killed, the unarmed man who was shot on the eve of his wedding. So that's not an argument that I made first. But in addition, what we found is that these are systemic problems and that you can change the complexion. You may diminish some of this by changing the complexion of the people who are there. But if an institution fundamentally operates in a way that's hostile towards a, you know, particular community or to a particular socioeconomic group, then you still wind up having those problems replicated. Now, as per the caller's statement about the, you know, the great work that the NYPD does, that's fine. But tell that to Akai Gurley's family, the young man who was shot by the officer who shot him in Brooklyn. He was walking out of his door. And tell that to Eric Garner's family. And so at the end of the day, we can't simply say, you know, these are one-offs. And, you know, statistically, we know people of color unarmed. Let's not say, you know, with this argument about criminality or people getting what they deserve. We know that unarmed people of color, unarmed African-Americans, are somewhere around 20 times more likely to be shot and killed by police than unarmed white people are. And to say that this does not have a racial contention is simply a racial element is simply to ignore data. I mean, this is what's confronting us. And so somehow when we look at, you know, race in a salient way that it tends to impact this society, we're seen as race baiters as opposed to simply pointing out what the data tell us. And we can't afford to at the expense of people's humanity and the quality of their lives. We can't simply afford to ignore that.
But there is a widespread perception, certainly in white America, that a lot of the difference in these statistics by race have to do with differences in behavior within the different communities. I'm going to skip the Rudy Giuliani clip and how ham-handed he was and the way he put it on Meet the Press. But I'm going to go to the Charles Barkley moment on CNN. Excuse me while I clear my throat. The Charles Barkley moment on CNN that you also put in your New Yorker article and wanted to talk back to, where he was asked about this same contention about if there's racial profiling really, or if there is disparate rate, if there are disparate rates of bad behavior.
We as black people, we got a lot of crooks. We can't just wait until something like this happened. We have to look ourselves in the mirror. There's a reason they racially profile us at times. Sometimes it's wrong, but sometimes it's right.
What do you say to Charles Barkley?
I think that's a terrible statement, and it's probably indicative of the way that a lot of people think, and that's tragic, because the logic of it is, we were just talking about this numerically. One, let's just kind of start. There's so much to unpack there. It believes in a particular kind of collective assignment of guilt. So if the majority of carjackers in a particular zip code were black, that does not mean the majority of black people in that zip code are carjackers. And so we know this from, you know, our high school logic classes and mathematics classes. So that's one problem. Beyond that, we don't look at this as a kind of one-way racial thinking. I also pointed out in that piece was that if we discarded, if we took out every single homicide that involved a black perpetrator and or a black victim, this country would still be more violent than many Western European industrial democracies now. And so we'd be more violent than the UK. We'd be more violent than the Netherlands. We'd be – I've listed a number of countries that we have violence, more violence than. But we'd never look at white people in America and say, you all are really violent. We need to profile you. You're more violent than other societies are, and what's wrong with you? Moreover – and this is kind of where the logic falls down. When you see an offense that's committed against a particular person in a community, and then you recite, you know, whatever behavior that has completely nothing to do with this situation. It was like if we looked at a terrorist attack September 11th and said to Americans, white Americans, well, you know, statistically, you're far, far more likely to be killed by another white person in this country. So I don't know why you all are really fixated on this one particular thing. You understand how outrageous that logic is you know, to people in the black community.
You know, there's so much more we could do that we're not going to have time for. But I wonder, why does CNN even go to Charles Barkley as a commentator on black behavior? Would they go to Larry Bird as an expert on whites?
No, they really wouldn't. And also, I mean, not to be ad hominem, but, you know, Charles Barkley has a history of violence himself. And if someone were to say to him when he threw that young man through a plate glass window, as was reported, allegedly, if he had been said then, oh, well, you're a thug, and if a police officer in some completely separate instance ended his life under really questionable circumstances, people would have said, was this use of force absolutely necessary in that circumstance? And so, I mean, it's very difficult to say that when we look at racial profiling, that it's anything different than racism. If you ask a racist person, an avowed racist person, to make an assessment, and then you ask someone to make a racially profiled, you know, assessment of that same situation, the tendency is that those two people are going to come to the same conclusion.
Can we say, at least, though, as a matter of history, for you as a historian, that police departments are making progress in the way they police? Just looking at a few of the stats that I have here, according to the Justice Department, the number of incidents in which force was used or threatened nationwide, all police forces, declined from 664,000 in 2002, down by about 100,000 to 574 in 2008. And in New York City, 10 years ago, there were 61 instances in which officers shot at suspects, just 40 of them last year, so down by a full third in New York City. Can we say that police are doing better, that the, you know, the big sweep of history tells us things are going in the right direction and now there's more focus on them and maybe this is a tipping point to take a next step?
One would hope, but I'm not sure that that's what that data says. One, you know, we've seen kind of nationally falling crime numbers, and that may have something to do with it as well. One would hope that this is corresponding to better policing policies. But the other thing that's very troubling is that in most police departments, there's no systematic gathering of the number of fatalities in those departments in any given year. So we still don't entirely know how often police officers use their weapons against civilians.
Jelani Cobb, Associate Professor of History and the Director of the Africana Studies Institute at the University of Connecticut and a regular contributor to The New Yorker. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
It's our family meeting on race and justice. Is this a tipping point? And next we'll ask, is it a tipping point for how you talk to your children about these issues, whether you're black, white, or other? Parents, call in 212-433-WNYC, and we'll talk to two guests. Stay with us. WNYC. It's our family meeting on race and justice. Is this a tipping point? And now, is this a tipping point in your family, black, white, brown, or any mixture thereof, for talking to your kids about race and racial injustice and these stories in the news? Once your kids hear about Ferguson, once they hear about Staten Island, what do you say? And does it differ by race? 212-433-WNYC. Parents, we want to hear your stories. 212-433-9692. And I'm joined for this by two New York Times columnists, KJ Della Antonia, editor and lead writer of the Motherlode blog for The Times, who has written specifically on the question of how and how much to say about these issues, and by Rachel Swarns, who writes the Working Life column at The Times, but had that recent op-ed that some of you, I'm sure, saw about her heartbreak over having to have this conversation with her son. Welcome back to the station, KJ Della Antonia and Rachel Swarns. Hi.
Hi.
And this is a family matter for regular people, if we can call ourselves that, and elected elite alike.
Shirley and I have had to talk to Dante for years about the dangers that he may face. Good young man, law-abiding young man, who never would think to do anything wrong, and yet, because of a history that still hangs over us, the dangers he may face. We've had to literally train him, as families have all over this city for decades, in how to take special care in any encounter he has with the police officers who are there to protect him.
And here's Ken Thompson, the Brooklyn DA, from my conversation with him earlier in the show, as he refers to seeing the Eric Garner video. And we'll get to Ken Thompson coming up. Rachel Swarns, how old is your son?
He's 7 years old.
And you're right that he said, the seven-year-old, I heard a police officer killed a black man named Michael Brown. Why wasn't he arrested? Wow, how did you start with a seven-year-old?
You know, it was a conversation, I have to be honest, that I didn't want to have. And it caught me off guard because I had actually done as much as I could to keep it from happening. I, you know, hid the newspapers and turned off the radio, but not fast enough. He heard it, you know, in the kitchen, I guess, as I was getting things ready or as he was coming in. And I really, you know, I was in the car and I was taken aback and, you know, I didn't know what to say, but I knew I had to answer the question, and so I told him it was complicated, and I went through what happened in that instance. It's hard to talk to a 7-year-old about grand juries and race and law enforcement in the city and the country, but we started on something like that.
Well, did you tell a 7-year-old that the world is unjust when it comes to the treatment of black men?
I told him that there's a history and that people are concerned and that people are protesting and that there are a lot of worries about young black men and how they are treated by the police. You know, a lot of African-American parents have what is known as the talk with their sons about the specifics. And it's not just African-American parents. As you heard, the mayor, Bill de Blasio, talked to his son about you may be at risk, and here is how to protect yourself. I didn't do that with my son, but I talked to him about the history and why there are these concerns about what happened in Ferguson and in Staten Island.
So, KJ, the challenge is different for white parents, isn't it?
Definitely, and I chalk it up to another addition to privilege, but I look for opportunities to have the conversation. I don't want them to... I have hated the last opportunities that we have had, but I think it's really important with my kids, who are also older, that my oldest son is 13, to find places to tell them that this is what happens, that you will see it, but you will not be a victim of it. And for you to know about it is part of, I hope, getting it to change as time goes on.
I noticed one thing you wrote, that not talking about race and racial differences with children doesn't say we don't notice that people have different colored skin and differently textured hair. It tells them that we don't talk about things like that. Why is that an important distinction?
That is so important. It is amazing how many white parents in particular fall into that trap. It's more comfortable to be colorblind. We'd rather be colorblind. We want to imagine that we live in the post-racial society. So our hope is, look, if we don't mention someone's race, if we don't talk about the fact that some people may be discriminated against or that there may be an implicit and unspoken bias against people based on their skin color. If we don't talk about those things, they will go away because you won't know about it, so you'll never feel it. But there is extensive research that shows that's not the way it works. Kids notice these things, and they're sorting them out for themselves. The result that you will get if you don't talk about this with your child is that they will draw conclusions based on the media that they're watching and the other things they see happening around them.
Scott in Queens, you're on WNYC. Hi, Scott.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Listen, I just would have no problem at all telling my 17-year-old or 17-year-old, I have 3 children, and we've had these discussions, and I said recently that, you know, if you're black or white or green or purple, if you strike a police officer, you might get hurt. You might get shot, and I'm not going to defend you if you're my child. If you resist arrest, if you strike out at them, if you charge them, you might get killed.
Did you tell my screener you have mixed race kids? Is that correct?
Well, yeah, I'm Asian. My ex-wife is Asian, and we have a lot of their friends are African American and Latino, and so we've had a lot of talk and a lot of discussion.
And your kids are white and Asian mix. I'm just trying to be clear.
Right. Right.
Okay.
Right. And my youngest was with me in Manhattan a few months ago when I stood up. I happened to be at Union Square and stood up for the Yazidis and Kurds were there, and I spoke out for them and got in an argument with a photographer, and the policeman came to me, and I almost got arrested. They misunderstood the situation. In any event, he kept arguing with me, and I was saying, look, I'm not the one harassing here, but I'm overweight too, and I told my kids, my daughter was there, and she came up, Dad, you know, calm down. And and I thought I could be arrested. But I determined in my mind, number one, not only am I overweight and I don't want to go down, but number two, my moral character is I'm not going to resist arrest. If they resist, I'll just fight it later.
And so after telling your kids what you told them, sounds like they had to remind you. So, Rachel Swines, is that part of the talk when your son gets older?
You know, I think that it was interesting, some of the letters and tweets and emails that came in. I think one thing that's interesting about our caller's comments is that there were a number of people who said, well, you know, it's fairly simple, you know, don't hit a police officer. But the experience of African-American young men is that they are often stopped and questioned or frisked, or you know, some of the police shootings in the city involved people who weren't resisting arrest. So I think it's not simply don't hit a police officer. I think for older children, people talk about, don't raise your hands, don't move quickly. This goes beyond, I think most parents who are having this discussion, are raising and praying that they will have kids who are, respectful, law-abiding people who aren't going to be in the business of assaulting the police. But we know, sadly, that the things happen even when you're not doing that. And that's really where the concern is. And I think that something that KJ said is important, which is about, as a parent, at least in my house, feeling like, you're open to the talk. This is to talking about these issues, even if they are hard. This was a conversation I had hoped to have with my son, years from now. But we have talked about things that come up, because things do come up. Things come up in their lives. They know about history. They know about slavery. They know about discrimination. And I think we can't, as parents, pretend that these things don't exist.
Rogers in Harlem. You're on WNYC. Hello, Rogers. Rogers, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. How are you today?
Good. Go ahead.
The reason I called is I'm an educator. I'm a professor of 13 years. I did a lecture at the Microsoft building, and the topic was the coding debacle, finding computer programmers in the 21st century, Black and Latino programmers. And what we did a lot of research on this topic. And one of the glaring things we found was that one of the reasons our kids are not getting educated properly, because at the community center, and we try vigorously to install various programs, like, for example, digital technology, mobile app development, which is what we're trying to do now at various community centers and organizations. We have found so much, I just call it negative bank, in terms of getting these things in. We discovered that there's a myriad of computer systems across New York. There's 32 state-of-the-art labs, but yet those labs continue to run remedial programs. And what bothers me is that, okay, there's police brutality, and that's one cause in the field of Cox, but African-American leaders are getting away with not producing any type of transformative programs in their own communities.
Right, Rogers, I'm going to leave it there. Rachel, do you think the focus gets too one-pointed sometimes? Because issues like Staten Island and Ferguson, the issues that flow from those incidents, are so emotional and overwhelming, and they're matters of life and death, that we don't talk enough to our kids about the larger, structural things that might be as important for long-term progress?
I think that these conversations are hard to have, and I think that there is, a lot of emotion and, concern and worry and fear that parents have, when they look at situations like that. And I think kids are, especially young ones like mine, are just confused, about what they're seeing. I think we do have to talk about history. I think we do have to talk about what has changed and what has not. I mean,
And we just have 30 seconds left. So, KJ, I know you talked with an expert about these conversations, and she pretty much said, if they don't make you profoundly uncomfortable while you're doing this with your children, you probably did it wrong.
That's exactly right. And we can't get distracted by other shiny topics, Brian. We have to look at the structural bias and the implicit bias that we're dealing with. We have to talk about these things. We really do.
KJ Delantonia, editor and lead writer of the Motherlode blog for the New York Times. Rachel Swarns is the Times Working Life columnist and author of American Tapestry, the story of the black, white, and multiracial ancestors of Michelle Obama. Thank you both very much for joining the conversation.
Thank you.
Thanks to all of you. Obviously, at the end of this family meeting on race and justice, is this a tipping point? This is yet another piece of the conversation that needs to be ongoing in this country and will continue to be ongoing on this program. Thank you very much for your voices, for your comments. You can keep tweeting at Brian Lehrer, post to facebook.com/BrianLehrerWNYC, or on our webpage, WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. Have a great weekend, everyone. That's our family meeting on race and justice. Is this a tipping point?